Hello, friends, and welcome to another episode of Just Another Kill Team Podcast, connecting Kill Team communities across the globe. Your hosts today are me, I'm Jason.
And I'm Travis, regular co-hosts.
We connect with all sorts of different people, TOs, competitive players, and just anyone else that has something interesting to say that they message us and convince us to talk about on an episode.
Yeah, we do like making the world a little bit smaller, one hobbyist at a time.
We do have a Discord and a Patreon, which is definitely some stuff that you should check out if you enjoy our content.
And if you do enjoy this podcast, make sure to share it with your friends who play Kill Team, because the more, the merrier.
In today's episode, we've got John from Goonhammer joining us as we talk about Kill Team Nightmare.
So we're here to talk about the big news of the weekend with my co-author on Goonhammer, John.
Oh, hey guys. Here to talk about Nightlords and Mandrakes?
Only spooky things on this podcast today.
Yep. It's the Halloween special early. Congratulations, everyone.
Yeah, just a bunch of surprising dudes popping out of the shadow to say hello with a knife, send you back into the shadow realm.
Yeah, I mean, I've been watching some of the conversations. It seems like a lot of people are worried that these two teams are going to break the game. What do you fellas think? First impressions, are they going to just destroy everything, or are they going to just kind of splash around and be fine and dandy?
I think JD came in way safer than I did, so I'll let JD start.
Okay, yeah, I have opinions, so As me and Travis, for full view, wrote the Goonhammer review for Nightlords. Travis is super pumped on them, and they are a very good team. I don't think anyone who is a fan of the Nightlords will be disappointed with this rule set. I come down a little hard on their faction rule, which is kind of bland when you compare it to what the Mandrakes get. But if you're a fan of Chaos Space Marines, they can do all the stuff Legionnaires can do. They take a slight durability and lethality hit, but they get a bunch of fun tricks to make up for it. So that's the best way to put it. Mandrakes, like all elf teams, have a number of things that will probably infuriate the other players, and I'm sure John from Can You Roll a Crit will be talking about this too. A potentially game-breaking ability, especially on close quarter. But overall, both rules are fantastic. They're also, I would say, above average strength. Night Lords definitely have an edge up on their elite counterparts, and kind of, I think, lead the way in terms of what we would like to see out of elite teams going forward to help them kind of match up with the more numerous teams. Mandrakes will probably infuriate some people depending on the matchup, and then run into a brick wall when they run into something like Gellar Pox that can really tank their bullshit. So that's kind of my takeaway.
What about you, Travis?
Me and Jason actually played a couple games, just like practice games with the pair of teams. And I came away feeling far safer on the Mandrakes than I had thought while reading the rules. I think while reading the rules, you just kind of bake in that every time a rule says you are within shadow, that it's just always on. And it's very easy to read the rules. Like, yeah, I'm just going to always be in shadow. Why would I not be in shadow? But like a good opponent will just stand in the open and force you to come to them. And then when you charge them, your weapons are just 4-5, lethal 5, which is not a good breakpoint. Like you'll 2-shot all the 7-wound operatives, but then you're just standing in the open getting shot. So the Mandrakes end up feeling much safer, I think, than they look on paper. Because I think when I read them, they looked broken. But I came away from the Nightlords rules being like, this team is going to be a big problem because they have all the tools that I think elites need to scrim against all the teams. And I think they kind of dunk on everyone except for maybe Custodes as far as like the elites go, just because the elites, like Custodes, just out elite them so hard that even with the extra activations, the Custodes, if they touch you, you still die. What about you, Jason? How are you feeling about them?
Well, the direct comparison with the Nemesis Claw to Legionary, like playing a lot of elites lately, I'm always looking for something that gets you slightly better action economy. So like regular Legionary has the Aspiring Champion that can do free actions when he kills dudes. And you got the Mark of Tzeentch that lets you take extra actions. And Nightlords don't really have anything like that. But the tricks they do have are very powerful. So it is like fundamentally like a different way to play. The prescience is super cool, I mean, I just, my first impression, like, the first couple games that I'm going to do with them is probably just going to be five flayed skin for equipment. Because it's simple and just, like, turning people's rerolls off, like, means even your people that aren't amazing in melee, people really, like, don't want to risk just raw dice trying to fight a space marine.
Yeah, and that Skinner model on the Night Lords is, like, extremely brutal. If he kills someone and someone else sees him do it, you're like, oh, that guy's just worthless for a whole turning point. Which is kind of like a two-for-one for free. And it's very hard to stay out of a six-inch range while he does it. So I feel like Night Lords are going to be one of the better elite teams, if not the best elite team, when they come out, if people can use all of the things that make them good. Because while, you know, JD is right, their special rule is not that interesting, it does give you new approaches that you didn't have before. Because now you can walk up underneath a piece of Octarius and just be on spooky, and people are like, oh no, there is an elite there, I can't shoot him. They're just like, so it just gives you new approaches that I think could be valuable.
Yeah, the in Midnight Clad, I think, actually solves a lot of the problems that I had trying to do all melee legionary, just because it's really, really hard not to get shot on turn one. But I feel like that'd be a lot easier with the in Midnight Clad special rule.
Yeah, you can stage, I think, basically like 7 inches away from anything important, hiding in and around shadow. And if you can set that up on conceal, then on turn two, your opponents now either have to move up to shoot you, which is not great for you, but you've got a 3-up save and maybe that's fine. But if they try to do that, you Vox Scream them and you punch them in the face.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the reason I found in Midnight Clad so underwhelming was that it was kind of the inverse of the shadow rule that Mandrakes get, where the Night Lords have to satisfy all the criteria to benefit, while Mandrakes kind of just have to do one of them. Mandrakes, and that was kind of
flexible activation, but it's because all of their power is tied up on whether or not they are in shadow, whereas Midnight Clad is like a boost to survivability that just kind of like floats around. But you're right, it does feel weird when you read the pair of rules together. You're like, why is it that this only gives you obscurity and it feels like I have to do all this work? And it's almost trivial on the Mandrakes. To be fair, you have to be around heavy cover, so on open it's not everything that it works around, and then on in the dark Mandrakes feel like they are extremely powerful because you can just always be around heavy.
Yeah, and like in Midnight Clad works with light cover as well. So it's basically like super conceal. And then you can just kind of be like standing sort of out in the open where it looks like you should be a really easy shot. But if it's from beyond six, you're going to be obscured.
You still have to be under... it's
like
actually, hold
within
on.
1 inch of any kind of cover, light or heavy, and with a conceal order, and the enemy's more than six away. So you could really just like stand next to a barricade without it getting in your way to slow down your charge at all. And as long as your enemies are outside of 6 inches, you can just like stand there safely. And then that is kind of like the answer to get those longer charges, because you don't have to go around stuff. You just stand next to it.
Yeah, Jason, I think you have a good point. It does allow the Nemesis Claw to do a very decisionary, and from Vox Scream.
Yeah, Vox Scream is the delay one.
They can go into turning point two very strong, even if they don't have the initiative. And if they do have the initiative, they could potentially gut their opponent if their opponent has been too aggressive moving forward to meet them. So that is something people will have to watch. I think it will take people by surprise at first.
Yeah, and then also looking at the team, it kind of looks to me like the melee build it works for me better because of that safer approach. And then kind of the same thing that Assault Intercessors had going on, where your five dice on threes with four damage a pop is going to more reliably kill stuff. Whereas if you're like trying to like run up and like even like shoot someone with a plasma gun, like they don't have like native rerolls unless someone's injured. And it's just like they don't really have anything that synergizes with their shooting that well. They don't have veteran to long war. So it's kind of like most of their like killy synergy is in the melee realm. So, that's kind of another like crazy thing that I wasn't like 100% expecting, but thinking about it for, you know, a decent chunk of time. And I was like, I think that's the build for it.
And I guess I realized that, you know, we kind of jumped ahead of ourselves in case any of our listeners haven't decided to go look at all the rules and read our articles on Goonhammer and watch Can You Roll Crit's video. You know, in Midnight Clad requires you to have a conceal order, be within 1 inch of heavy or light terrain, and have any part of your base underneath a vantage point and be more than 6 inches away, while within Shadow on the Mandrakes is I think you have to be within an inch of heavy terrain specifically, or be underneath a vantage point. And I think that's basically it. Or within a shadow token, if I remember correctly.
Yes, the inch of the shadow portal that the one operative can make. Yeah, that's one of those three criteria is all they require.
Yeah, and all the mandrakes basically unlock every single operative, and half of their rules are based around whether or not you're touching shadow.
There is definitely boards that they would struggle on. I can see once they have to basically get onto the vantage points of Beta Decima, they can find themselves in a bad spot. Or just certain Octaria setups where everyone knows the one where you're going to find a objective that's sitting in the open, and the only way to defend it is to put a little barricade on it. Now, I think they do get equipment that gives operative super conceal.
Super conceal, for two equipment points.
So there is a way to mitigate that, but they do have good equipment, and you're going to be probably spinning it on that super conceal to make up for any of the weaknesses the team finds itself in board setups.
Yeah, they've got pretty flexible equipment, which I think is nice, but ultimately they're nine operative team with 8 wounds, living on a 5-up invuln or 4-up invuln if you're in shadow. So staying in shadow is going to be basically like the most important thing. If you ever leave shadow with the mandrakes, your opponent better have been chipped already, because otherwise you are basically wasting your time, even though you've got pretty okay shooting, because you're only ever shooting at people basically at -1 whatever their normal save profile is.
I was gonna say you're rocking team wide bolters basically with the equivalent of AP1 against elite teams, and nothing really against more horde based teams. But you do have a way to boost damage against a single target thanks to the abyssal. But other than that, yes, they're at the mercy, and they can never double shoot. I don't think they can ever double fight, and they don't have any APL modification either. So that is,
they've got the one.
Oh, they do?
They've got the Chooser of Flesh. So, like, the most important operative on the entire Mandrakes team is they have one melee operative called the Chooser of Flesh. And if he gets a kill, he steals a soul. And then someone else can eat the soul. And if they eat the soul, they either heal for D6, which is fine, but, you know, that's not what we're here for. Or you can add an APL to an operative. And I think at the moment, you could theoretically do this over two separate turning points and add four, like have someone go to 4 APL. There's nothing in it that says it caps it at 3, because you're increasing the APL like characteristic.
Yeah,
I don't think there's anything that stops you from going to 4 at the moment. I don't know if that's what they wanted, but it is very cool. If you kill a Marine, they're worth 2 souls. But when we've played the team, if you didn't get a kill with the Chooser, the team feels very kind of miserable. And I think it's a very similar problem to Hand of the Archon, where they feel very good, but they have no comms. So if you ever are not able to get something that your opponent doesn't want you to get, you're playing a fair game with 18 APL, which is just it's just tough. But the Mandrakes have the ability to steal a soul forever and turn your team into like 2 mini Marines or 1 mini Marine, that's definitely the most important operative on the team. And if he doesn't get his kill, generally, I think the game is going to be kind of impossible for them, is what it feels like. Just because you don't have enough raw stats to really beat other people, even though all of your stats are pretty okay. There's just nothing that feels unfair until you get to 3 APL, so you can like charge fight, soul blast someone else, steal a point.
Yeah, I mean, it does kind of feel like they're gonna have the same problem that Harlequins had been having, where like they're gonna feel tough to fight against. For like, if someone is really good at Mandrakes and they're playing against newer players, they're gonna have a nightmare. But then like once they get to the top tables, it's kind of like you can just stand somewhere where they don't have any corners to hide in and just take points and blast people, and it's totally fine. Or just like run up and shoot them point blank, and like just like pure aggression, kind of just like they don't really have anything to like slow your roll if you try to do that.
Yeah, they're a much frailer team than I think they look like. They've got the ability to heal in combat, they've got a lot of tricks, but a lot of them require you to stay in shadow. So while it is like Creeping Horror is probably one of their craziest strategic ploys, and it basically says every time your enemy activates, you can take one Mandrake that's concealed and in shadow, and you can have them dash as long as they end up within shadow. So everyone on your team can take a free dash as long as they stay within shadow, which sounds crazy good. But if you imagine most open boards, the first piece of heavy terrain you're around just lets you kind of like phase around it, but it doesn't let you go anywhere because you can't leave the shadow to another spot, because generally the next piece of heavy is not 3 inches away or 4 inches away with your equipment. It's like 6 inches away. So you're just kind of like, you're just like phasing back and forth between like a thing.
Or if it's something you can get to, it's the only thing they can get to. So do you want to bunch up a thing, you know, half your team on that one spot and then get vaporized by a grenade or something like that, which with 4-up invuln saves in shadow, if you don't have shadow, you're in deep shit. You don't have the feel no pain like your Hand of the Arkham Brethren. Yeah, they will evaporate just like any other elf team, maybe quicker than other elf teams if you play anywhere incorrectly with them.
Yeah, they definitely read very powerful, very cool. I do think that they're a team that feels the loss of having extra bonus operatives probably more than I've seen in recent memory. Like the fact that you are forced to take four kind of like goons that just kind of do the same thing as everyone else is kind of weird, but I guess those four dudes are like the suicide squad that chips people away for all of your special operatives to go do the rest of the work. But it's definitely like from a couple games, it feels like there's a lot to remember. And then I feel like they're not necessarily better than where Void Dancers were, but Void Dancers are also worse than where they were, so maybe it's fine.
Yeah, I think it's going to take a while for people to like crack the code and play them well. And I don't think their win rate at first is going to be that high. And like a lot of their tools are so like unusual, it's going to take a lot of practice games. Like the tools they have to mess up your activation order, because they've got the one dude that can like eyeball somebody super hard, and then like he can go before them. And then is it your leader that has the aura?
The leader has Harrowing Whispers. Yeah, one of like the craziest abilities.
Yeah, do you have that pulled up and can like read that off?
Yeah,
it's pretty bananas.
So Harrowing Whispers is the Mandrake Night Fiend's main ability, and definitely like probably one of the craziest abilities I think they've given to an operative, especially against two APL operatives. So it says each time your opponent would activate a ready enemy operative within 6 of this operative, you can roll 1d6. If the result is greater than the enemy operative's APL, they cannot activate in this activation. If there are no other enemy operatives eligible to be activated, this ability has no effect. So basically, you can like slingshot your Night Fiend close to a bunch of dorks, and then you just play the casino every time your opponent tries to activate anyone in the bubble. So I think when we were trying it, we had 3 Marines trying to activate around the Night Fiend, and the one Marine failed for 3 activations and then got killed.
Yeah, because it was like, I had like my whole team clustered around because I like wasn't thinking about that at all. I think we like talked about it a little bit, and I was like, I'm going to activate this guy, and you're like, roll off. No, you're not. I was like, I'm going to activate this guy, and then it was like, roll off. No, you're not. I was like, I'm going to activate this guy, and it's like, roll off. No, you're not. It was like 3 in a row, and I was like, I guess I'll just activate the other guy that I just
don't care. We were like, about. We went to the entire other end of the map, which was hilarious.
So if you go, what if you go through your whole team?
Then it does nothing. It says that
around to the start.
It says that if no other enemy operatives are eligible to be activated, then you ignore it. So yeah. Like, but it's pretty funny though, because like imagine like the Vet Guard. You're like, oh no, there's like 6 dudes around this Night Fiend, and none of them activate until who knows how long it's going to take for you to do anything useful in that bubble, which is hilarious. But it also feels like kind of insane as a conceptual ability to give an operative.
I think that's probably going to be like the centerpiece around the most like abusive and feels bad strategies. Like, I'm not mad about it yet. We'll see how that shakes out after getting some more games in.
Especially because Mandrakes have one of the more cool equipment of taking an objective and giving everybody -1 APL around it. So if you happen to do that and you set up your Mandrake Night Fiend leader and he runs over there, it's like, all right, I got to roll a 1. Otherwise, you can't activate
anyone. The obvious play around is people will activate 6.1 inches away from him and then come in and try to screw him up. It's a very interesting ability. It's like all their abilities, it's good. Like, I'm trying to think of a single thing that's under the rule set where I'm like, oh, this is pointless.
The worst thing about them is just the elf fragility. You know, like they might have all the elf tricks in the world, but at the end of the day, 8 wounds means you can't make really any mistakes. And like they can heal, but you only heal once a turn. And it's not a guarantee of a lot of health, because it's the number of times you struck an opponent in a fight times XS.
Is it like times their APL or something?
I think it's the number of times multiplied by the APL. Yeah, so if you hit someone twice and then you kill a two APL operative, you gain four wounds back, which is good. But it's just, there's only so much healing to go around. So elites for me feel like that's where Mandrakes feel like they'll have an issue, because as good as their shooting is, it's not really going to take down an elite, because elites are not going to give you three Mandrakes worth of shooting on turn one normally. And then by the time they hit you, it's too late because they two-shot you.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I do think like Mandrakes in general are kind of like stealthily like one of the best shooting teams in the game, because having like that much three up shooting all at once, and then also the fact that it's all worsens it, like it inverses,
it worsens
your save.
The save characteristic, yeah.
So it like worsens their saves. They hit on threes, it's 3-4, and then your gunner is flexible, because then you can just have any goon then just like pump it up to be like your gunner profile for the turn, which I think is really interesting. it's a really cool mechanic for like how to use a gunner in a team.
They definitely feel like a team that really needs to find ways to do a lot of chip damage. So I think that's really where the skill is going to be. If you can chip people down, then you get your chooser of flesh to get a kill, and then suddenly your Night Fiend now has 3 APL. He charges, fights, kills a dude, shoots someone else, and now everyone that tries to react around him is now spooked. That's just gotta be terrifying.
Does Creeping Shadow require you to be concealed or just in shadow?
You gotta be concealed and within shadow. So it's there's a lot of conditions. It is an insane ability that means that on In the Dark, you probably won't get charged unless you want to be charged on turn two.
Yeah, I was more wondering if you could use it to shoot people and then get out of the way when they activate, but no, it doesn't appear that way, because I don't think they have a single silent weapon, do they?
No. But you could slither out of sight. That's one of the other attack ploys. So after you like shoot someone, you flip back to conceal, and then you can creep
away. You get the old
away.
Worm blade pop back one.
A little bit.
Of the cool guns.
But you do have to be within shadow. So like, again, if you're not within shadow, the team doesn't do anything. So there are a lot of positional things that you are committed to doing. And if you don't do them, the team is not good, because it's like literally like half your ploys just don't do anything.
Yeah. And as we know, like we point out, in close quarters is probably their best their best environment, but most objective markers kind of sit in the middle of a room, well away from a wall. And at some point your Mandrakes are gonna have to move on to that, and you're gonna have to just take it and hope that it goes your way. Hope those five up invuln saves come through for you.
Yeah. There's definitely they definitely feel way sketchier than they read, because definitely when I read them through when we first got our review copies, I was like, wow, this team seems insane. But after playing with it, I'm like, now this team seems very hard to play, and I am not worried about them.
Oh, maybe my concern was that, I don't do as much TAC op analysis as I should for teams that I don't play. See people being concerned with what is the recon one to get to your, is it Courier? So someone
they have really easy scoring opportunities for sure.
And using the primary, which we haven't even talked about, Shadow Walk, is that what it's called?
It was Shadow Passage. Yes, the big ability that everyone was spooked
about this. You can just be like, man, I'm getting rinsed. This is my courier, and he's going to teleport to the other side of the table, and there ain't jack shit you can do about it, unless your team is numerous enough to cover all the visibility angles of the board. Well, which
the thing is, it's not visibility, it's full line of sight. So like, it's definitely manageable to actually stop Shadow Passage on most open boards by just having some goon in the back of the map staring at the entire board.
Yeah.
On In the Dark, it's impossible. Like, they're gonna Shadow Passage whenever they want, but on open, it's surprisingly easy. Like, for a horde team, there's never gonna be a Mandrake in your back line if you just keep Shadow Passage in mind. So I think that's like the big thing that everyone is worried about. But it is an operative performs normal move, but instead of moving, you just teleport it somewhere else. It's got to be within shadow, which means that it either is underneath the vantage, within 1 inch of heavy, or within 1 inch of a shadow portal token. But it also cannot be in line of sight, which is the entire chart of like visibility, obscurity, and then your cover rules. So if you're just like teleporting behind a building, but someone is looking back and cuts the line where you get no cover, which is not that hard on most Octarius board. If you really think about how Octarius looks, if you teleport behind a wall, generally for a person, like for a Vetguard team or a 12 operative team that's moved up a little, there's not a lot of places for you to teleport. And even when me and Jason were playing six Marines, it was hard for me to find a useful spot to land a teleport. So it definitely reads like, ah, this seems crazy. But if it was visibility, it would be crazy. But it happens to be line of sight, which means that as long as you have a dude like who can kind of see the back edges, it's not that bad. And just keep in mind that if you they can't teleport, they basically have to approach you fair, and they're not that good approaching you fair.
Yeah. Definitely another factor with like the line of sight thing is because like if people have a bunch of models on conceal, their line of sight is you can walk all over them. But
yeah, you know. you can really push your opponent around if they start nine operatives on conceal so they can do all this like tricky business, because you're like, all right, well, I'm just gonna run up to all the vantages, stand on all the points, be on engage and say like you don't do anything on turn one, which is fine. But then on turn two, their shooting is good, but it's not like it's not AP2 shooting. It's just solid shooting where one dude will chip off some wounds, but he's not often going to just like rinse a dude.
Yeah, the whoever gets is Soulfire from the Abyssal will be in trouble. But yeah, everyone else is kind of they can reliably expect even your guard mooks can reliably expect to at least require two activations to be shot to death by these guys.
So like they are very good. Like their rules all read like they get all these crazy rules, but at the end of the day, if you play against them and you think about their team as you play, you do have lots of ways to kind of stuff out some of the craziest things. And then they have to find a way to like create a realm of shadow. And I think that does feel very thematic, because once the shadow is there in the middle of the board and they start like teleporting in behind the lines, then it's going to feel very spooky.
Yeah, both of the teams definitely do feel very thematic, and I'm very like satisfied with how much they've landed like in the pocket of they're sufficiently spooky vibes.
Yeah, we were trying. We didn't even get to play around with the Ventrilocator. I think we just mostly played like fair matches, and it was just like, oh man, this is hard for these boys with eight wounds and bolters to kill these Marines.
Yeah, the Night Lord guys are all fun. I think I mentioned in my review that the Skin Thief is absolutely what I wish the Butcher was. Like the butcher goes to bed at night wishing he was the Skin Thief, and if hopefully like when we see changes in 3 months to teams, hopefully we see some of the elite teams that aren't Night Lords obviously get a little love. I think you could take a lesson from this in terms of the Butcher probably needs a fifth attack if nothing else, and probably needs to hit on threes if we're being realistic here, because I have not once ever played a game where the Butcher did anything but die horribly, whether I played as him or played against him. I want him to be good, but he just lets you down. And the Skin Thief is like, I'm there. I know what to do.
I think the Skin Thief is like the MVP of the Nemesis Claw. Like to me, it looks like pretty significantly by far like the best model on the team.
Yeah, he was pretty gross when we played. Just being able to like stop a dude within 6 inches who like saw you get flayed. That's very powerful ability, because the Skin Thief, when he flays someone alive, he picks someone else within 6 inches and says, see this? This is you next. And that guy can't do pickup actions, do mission actions, or touch objective markers.
Yeah, it's like the gross. Crimson Duelist.
It's does better, that. I think, right?
So I think it's like the same thing, like pretty much exactly. Maybe it has a bigger range, but the Crimson Duelist does the same thing. But this is on a Space Marine, and he can fight twice, and Duplicity for Murder lets you charge in the middle there. Could he theoretically charge, kill someone, make somebody not contest an objective, Duplicity for Murder into someone else, kill someone else, and then make someone else also not count as a model?
Because
if so, I think that's charge. The centerpiece. Because Duplicity for Murder lets you get there.
It's once per turning point.
So it's once per turning point. It's still absolutely insane, because like he can double kill plus like take somebody out of the fight. So that's
I guess
that's
on that topic, efficiency. We can zoom back over to the Night Lords a little bit. We talked a lot about Mandrakes, and you know, I think they'll be a very hot topic one, and maybe Night Lords will kind of like fly under the radar for most people. But Night Lords, I think, actually crazy strong. You know, we're talking about Proclivity for Murder right now. That's one of their tac ploys that basically lets you kill a dude and then charge again for 3 inches.
It's like which a baby is effectively just consolidate. Aggression.
Yep.
Because you have to pay a CP and you can only do it once. But still very good.
against most opponents, they're not going to give, like, when people take perpetual aggression as legionnaires, it's a decent opponent's not going to give you just a bunch of lineup shots, so you only really need that one tack ploy for that one guy who's going to get the bounce.
The other thing is, this is way less telegraph than perpetual aggression. You call it at the beginning of the turn, your opponent's like, oh, I gotta pay attention for the whole turn. But this one, just like the Felgor, the moment you make one mistake somewhere, your opponent's like, ah, gotcha, and jumps in your line. You're like, oh no, there's a giant space marine who just told someone else that he's going to flay them, and now he's chain-staring another dude who cannot run away.
Doesn't the skin thief get a damage reduction, too?
Yes. He does. He gets a damage reduction,
and it's to a
too.
Minimum of two. So he's just coming in with the grossness. He's going to be just ultra tanky. He's like the Anointed plus the Butcher plus the Hand of the Archon Crimson Duelist put all into one.
Yeah, the Flare.
And then, like,
yeah, the Night Lord, yeah, the Skin Thief is crazy.
You could give him the Grizzly Trophy to give people minus one attacks, and now he's just even crazy tankier. I feel like that, I don't know, it's a really good combo.
We were talking about Doom guys. This is like the team that's giving you another Doom guy, because you can stack all... Well, let's go through some of the equipment, Jason. You know, for the Night Lords, you've got Flayed Skin, which is no rerolls within three for two. You've got Grizzly Trophy, which is exactly the same as Legionnaires, which is kind of boring, but also not surprising that it would show back up here. What was that?
It works.
It works. It's great. It's excellent. Everybody loves it. We've got Chain Snare, which is if your opponent tries to fall back on a four up, they can't, which is also very good. When
you injure them, you get a plus one.
Suspensor system, boring, we don't care about that. Combat Blade, fine, not as good as the Malefic Blade, obviously, because Malefic Blade is insane. It's just four attacks on threes, 3/5, then a frag grenade and a crack grenade. But you could theoretically put six equipment points on the Skin Thief and just watch him just wreck shop, because he's got Chain Snares, Grizzly Trophies, and Flayed Skin. Like, if you don't shoot him, you can't kill him, and if he's touching a dude and he's Chain Snared two guys...
So
can't get rid of him.
The Grizzly Trophy, I don't remember where the wording is, but somewhere in there, there's a rule that you can't have the Grizzly Trophy and the Flayed Skin.
Oh, correct. It does say that on the Grizzly Trophy. It says not available for Opt with Flayed Skin. Right. No Doom guy, just covered in skin.
Right. Because it totally is. I mean, the Skin Thief is already the Doom guy of the team. He's just going to be going nuts. He's going to be doing all the work. He's going to be running all the errands.
So, I think is it with the Legionnaires? Because you do, if you're a Legionnaires player, this team will cut. This team is Legionnaires of Night Lord's characteristics, is basically kind of how it is. The raw stats of your team are the same. Since you don't get the Marks of Chaos, you do give up durability, whether it's not having any invuln saves across the whole team. Plasma and Melta will eat your lunch. And if you're not watching out for that, you could be real trouble. This is kind of like Kasserkins have always kind of liked fighting into elites, and that would be a team that would definitely love to probably go into Night Lords, because they can melt the opposing operatives pretty easily. There's also other trade-offs, like the Visionary, your leader, for example, has to actually make a trade-off when it comes to his melee weapon and pistol choice. Which is something I like when Games Workshop does this, where they're like, you can either have the best pistol option and the crappy melee option, you can have the best melee option and the crappiest ranged option, or you can have like this kind of middle ground. And so in the case of the Visionary, he does have to, he all his melee choices are decent, but the plasma pistol does come with the worst. Melee
option. The Nostrum and Chain Blade, which is five attacks on twos, 4/5 rending, which is respectable. Not incredible, respectable.
But it's no Demon Blade.
But he does come with the Portent ability. So when he has the Prescience tokens, he can at least, like, if your opponent doesn't roll well, he just be like, well, you rolled two dice, you rolled one. Get red, kid, and just, like, Shreks them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I'm pretty sure his plasma pistol hits on twos, doesn't it?
Sure does.
He's also a little bit less efficient with the ploys, where the Legionary just gives you a free strat ploy, and then his is you have to spend an action and a prescience token to get your command point back.
And this team does feel very, very CP hungry in comparison to Legionary. Legionary, because you get the free ploys, it kind of like, well, I'll spend like two strat ploys and maybe I'll do attack ploy from time to time. But this one, you definitely feel the crunch a little bit just because the APL is so much more important.
Yes, and Vox Scream goes up one CP. Every time you use it, too. Yeah. So Yeah. God forbid you have to use it a third time, because I don't know where you're going to find that CP. I hope you haven't been using any of it up to that point. But yeah, it's the way I look at them compared to Legionnaires is you're losing a little bit of durability, and you're probably losing a bit of lethality, because as you mentioned with Mandrakes, there's not a lot of rerolls with them, and the Night Lords are kind of in the same position. The Skin Thief is a perfect example. I'm pretty sure he doesn't have Relentless or Ceaseless on his weapon. Something at least the Butcher gets doesn't make up for the fact that he's kind of terrible, but if the Skin Thief did have Relentless, he'd still have the opportunity to screw you on dice, I guess. And since you're wanting to keep your CP in the bank for your really good ploys like Proclivity for Murder and Vox Scream, when the dice come up bad, which they will because it's kill team, you're going to face a hard choice on, man, do I really want to do command point rerolls?
Yeah, it's definitely a very... I think the Night Lords feel like a pretty tightly designed team. They just feel very powerful, I think, as a result, because they get to be good elites, but they also get to have more activations than most elite teams. And one of the cool things about Prescience tokens is there's no comment about them discarding at the end of a turning point. So theoretically, if you played super cagey, you could just like wait 6 activations at the beginning of turn 2 and just chill and watch your opponent play their entire turn and then just jump them.
Yeah, which, the Visionaries,
not likely, but hilarious.
The Visionaries ability is fantastic. The fact that it's the D3 generation, I think, is going to break people's hearts, because you're going to find yourself in a turn where you're like, man, I need more than one Prescience token or whatever. And it's going to come up a 1, and you're going to be in a bad spot. Like, there's a huge difference between 1 and 3 on that die.
Yep. I mean, we'll see. I suspect they'll be very good. This is definitely one of those things where, like, if the team feels a little weak, they could just be like, well, what about D3 plus 1? Does that help? And it's basically like a guarantee of 4 extra activations over the course of a game. So, like, if they, like, they don't need to add operatives or any of this other stuff to balance this team. If it turns out that they were too strong or too weak, they have a lot of levers. So they can, like, just touch this one thing and see what happens.
Yeah, and they had the complaint in my review. There are a few abilities they have that kind of feel they're pretty low compared to other stuff. But even when we compare this against past teams, if we had to do a percentage of useful abilities to non-useful or less useful abilities, they're still like in the 80 to 90% plus range. And historically, when you look at some of the kill teams, I play Wyrmblade all the time, and I got more than a few ploys that almost never get used. And so in that regard, Mandrakes and Night Lords are still way above average.
You're going to find something
for this stuff.
Night Lords have basically the funniest possible ploy, which is basically screw Imperium specifically, which no other team has in the game from what I remember. Like, I don't even think in Compendium there's like a thing that's like, I hate one faction specifically. Not even like Deathwatch has anything, right? Not that I recall. We might be wrong. If we're wrong, message us on the Discord or let us know in the comments.
Yeah, I would have to look it up. I could have swore there was like a fuck Chaos one somewhere in there, but at this point, I can't remember.
Like, there's like Psych Out Grenades on Custodes, but Death to the False Emperor is a Night Lord ploy. You use this tag ploy after rolling all of your tag dice against the Imperium keyword, and you can re-roll, I think, 1 die. But if it's against an Astartes specifically, you just re-roll everything. You just get relentless.
Yeah, so just like, relentless.
I made a little oopsie, and I was like, okay, well, against not even like half the teams in the game, you get like 1 re-roll, but then against specifically Space Marines, you just say, screw you guys. You punch them again, which is hilarious, because it like, there are no other teams with this design space, and I just assumed that we weren't going to carry this in, but here it is, Death of the False Emperor.
It'd be kind of funny if they were like, oh, but they're going to struggle against Intercession. They're like, Death to the False Emperor.
I mean, that might be what it's there for, honestly. Like, in testing, they're like, wow, Intercession's really hard.
I would have a hard time imagining Intercession having a hard time against Nemesis Claw, because they just have, like, multiple AP. Like, I think they just, like, hit harder and get there safer.
Yeah, I mean, they have the Melta and the Plasma Pistol, and they can do it all.
Wait, did you mean that... You think Intercession will be good against Nemesis Claw, or the other way around?
I think the other way around. I think Nemesis Claw is going to slap around the other elites.
Oh yeah, for sure. Decently, like, yeah.
Imagine Intercession. Imagine turn 2, your opponent as the Night Lord, has now saved up, you know, anywhere from 1 to 4, 1 to 6 prescience tokens. You're playing the Intercessor and you're like, I guess I'll play 4 activations in a row before you go. And you're like, yeah, you sure will. And you just watch them play half a turn and then you just jump them with your AP2 guns. Like, what are you supposed to do in that situation?
And then, like, if they do have a good angle on you, you just Vox Scream and then Plasma Pistol them? Yikes.
Yeah. I think they've got the tools to do all the fun tricks. One big complaint that I have on the pair of teams, actually, is archetypes. I don't really understand what the point of having archetypes are if we're just going to give 3 archetypes to every team. Because both of these teams have Infiltration, Recon, and Seek and Destroy. Like, I don't really get the point of having them if we're just going to give them to everyone. And that's one of my complaints about the box. I love the box, actually, and I think the narrative rules are good. The rules for Beta Decima are good. The pair of teams are good. The sculpts are great. But on balance, I'm like, what is the point of the archetypes if we're going to give them out this way? I don't know. How do you guys feel about it?
I think you got a good point, Travis. It does kind of beg the question of, at this point, would the game be better if everyone just gets all the archetypes, or are certain teams just going to like launch out of their kind of like out of the like whatever is hindering them thanks to their attack ops? At this point, I don't know if I could make a determination on it, but if I was part of like the rules balance team or playtesting team, that would be something that would be worth exploring. I tend to think like if a team is good, its tac ops are usually not what are making it good. It's the rules that are inherent to the team. And if you're a strong player and you know how to play the game, you're probably going to have a handle on primaries anyway. And I've seen everyone use all the tac ops effectively. Like I just played against security based teams at Adepticon, and they did just fine. Even though I remember when the decks came out, we were all kind of under the impression that security was one of the weaker ones, but if Adepticon's anything to go by, that is not the case.
Yeah, because like Hyrotech was doing security, Vetguard only has security.
Yeah, security was the best in the first like third of the game for a good reason, because you could score it on turn one. Now, if you just take a seat back, don't go like balls of the wall, blowing up operatives and trading off pieces super early, you can still play the same security game and just play the whole game, which is what you're supposed to do with security. So to me, it just feels kind of weird. Like, I felt like at the beginning of the game, teams were somewhat balanced around which archetypes they were allowed access to. For example, if Pathfinders got Seek and Destroy, it would have been pretty nice for me to just sit back and like blow people up while sitting in my drop zone for security, like for security or Seek and Destroy. I wasn't allowed to, and I was like, that's fine. I got to run up and die. That's part of the balance of my team. But now we're getting over to newer teams that are getting released with like, oh, we'll just take 3 of the archetypes. Like, why not? I'm like, what's the point then? Why do these older teams have these restrictions? So yeah, that's like my big complaint here. Like, I feel like they could have just been Seek and Destroy Infiltration or Recon Infiltration. It would have been fine. But I think in terms of like 4 players, having the backup of Seek and Destroy is a very nice fail-safe for like, oh, I don't know how to play the team, I guess I'll just play Seek and Destroy, right? So that's kind of where it's coming from, probably, because it just lets the game play easier. But from a balancing perspective, I think you lose a little bit when you just give everybody everything.
Because I think it's going to be an agreement. It makes the game more interesting.
Like, imagine if Wormblade could play security. You just like sit back, watch the mid line, just like blow people up as like you send a single dork to go stand on the mid line. You're like, yeah, I'll sit in my back line, go deal with that guy or lose.
Yeah, and I think that's something that like when you play a certain tac ops, it never really occurs to you. I think Adepticon this time around was the first time I really got to play against people who play that security mindset, because we just don't have a lot of Vanguard players. We got some people who play higher tech a lot, but you know, for the longest time they thought Recon was the way to go. And you know, it's kind of shown if you've got a nice open board, especially, that allows you to just kind of be like, make my day. I'll wait to turning point 4 kind of attitude. Those security ones can go a lot further than I would have given them before, but that's because I've been playing Infiltrate and Seek and Destroy for like 2 goddamn years now. I'm used to being aggressive.
Like a different scoring cadence that comes with different archetype decks. And I think security is one of those ones that kind of sneaks up on players who aren't used to playing against good security, because you can get 4 points from nowhere basically at the end of the game. You're like, wait, did I just lose? You're like, yeah, you did just lose, because you like they get center line, central control, and seize ground like twice, and then seize ground fully at the end of the game. You're like, oh no, I just lost 4 points. Because you're like, a lot of people calculate like turn by turn, but they're not thinking about like, oh, what's the actual game state going to be like at the end? And security can just come out of nowhere, especially on a team like Hirotech, which took Adepticon, you know, Shane did a great job, where you can kind of guarantee that you're going to have like 5 operatives at the end of the game if you're playing pretty cagey. But yeah, I don't know. I'm excited. I think the sculpts look really good. Jason, you've been poking around with your Night Lords. How are they coming along?
I've got them all put together. And I'm assuming you all can tell I've been sick, so I have added like an extra like 10 hours of sleep in my last couple days. They're totally built. They're cool. I'm excited. I realized I don't have a proper blue. I just have like a Latok blue and McCraig or whatever like the general Ultramarines is. So I'm like going to go scoop up some darker like the Night Lord's blue.
What about you, JD? Did you get to play around with any of the product in this release?
No, there's no one around me that is I'm allowed to tell the rules to play with, so I'd have to go to Tabletop Simulator if I want to do that. And I've kind of been a staunch like I want to play the physical game, and that just might be me being an old man who doesn't want to like actually learn how to play with Tabletop Simulator. So it's all theater of the mind for me. If nothing else, Jason, I can at least tell you how I painted my Shrive Talon, because he's a Night Lord. So
yeah,
it's a fun little scheme.
did you go with the normal, or like, I mean, what did you?
He's like 5 different types of blue with a little lightning bolts on his armor, and your standard like Retributor armor gold trim guy, but. He's got flayed skin on him, and he's a fun little guy to do. I could see painting a team like that. My 40K team is Ultramarine, so I've done plenty of blue. So in that respect, Nemesis Claw isn't really high on my painting list. I'm definitely excited to get the next Gene Stealer team painted, though.
Oh yeah, you would be. Filthy Gene Stealer player out here rubbing his claws. You got head start too.
My mandibles are salivating.
Your mandibles are clicking out there in the background. He posted a picture in like the Goonhammer like writers chat with his like his patriarch just in the background. He's like, I found the model. It's like, of course you did. It does look really, it's a really, really cool model. So
yeah,
I'm excited to see how it comes out.
It's a fantastic, it's one of those ones that I was only going to paint as a display piece for kind of like a diorama for them. And then when I saw, I was like, can't believe they're going to put this model in the goddamn game. It was bad enough we got custodians running around this table, but you're going to put what is kind of like really like stretching the kill team boundaries in terms of its scale.
Yeah, because like his claws are like 4 inches wide. I mean, like I haven't seen that model in a while, but I'm pretty sure, was it on a 50 millimeter base?
Yes. The question will be, will he be on 54 kill team or not? Well, we won't know until we see the actual rules, because the Blades of Cain got their, they came with certain base sizes, but I want to say in the rules they changed it. I can't remember what it changed it to and what they came as, but there was a shift in base size, and the Patriarch in the Brood Coven box is on a 40 millimeter, but I want to say he's, yeah, on a 50 for 40K. Something along those lines. So we'll see what he ends up on.
And I would be I'd be remiss if we don't at least take a pass on these swimming rules. Did you take a look at the extra rules for the narrative? For Nightmare?
Okay. You are blowing my mind, because I just thought John was like just bullshitting. I just thought you guys were fucking vibing. I don't know. Like I didn't catch it. So yeah, fill me in on the swimming rules, please.
Yeah, so, yeah, basically all the way, like, I think the big thing that I wasn't expecting for this edition Whereas for In the Dark, we all were thinking like, oh, what are they going to do with the crazy Space Hulk? Maybe we're going to have like, you know, Eldari ruins smashed up against Imperial ruins. And it was just like, oh, no, it's just Imperial ruins the whole way through, whatever. Like, just the Space Hulk of just all Imperial shit, whatever. Which we were all, I don't think that's what we were expecting when we first saw the terrain, right? But come Beta Decima, the extra narrative terrain in this box makes this box humongous. You know, in our video review, the box is like 2 times bigger than the Salvation box. And it's basically taken up by a piece of the tray that's literally half a board that just sits in the water that extends your play space. But the rules also for Beta Decima Nightmare add in swimming, where you can jump into the water and swim around the map. So it basically turns all the water parts into playable play space. And if you're in the water, you're in cover, but you cannot make shooting attacks.
Can you fight in the water?
It doesn't say anything about not being able to fight. So I do think that you can have a water duel.
And honestly, okay, having a knife fight while swimming does sound like a nightmare.
I tried to imagine Nemesis Claw Space Marines clad in fucking power armor swimming through the water.
While knifing a dude.
Shish kebabbing people on the lightning claws.
Do they get floaties? Is that how like I'm supposed to imagine this? Water wings
their
for your skin?
Floaties are made out of skin?
Yeah, exactly.
Take their armor off very quickly, wear the black carapace, and then go for a light jog.
Yeah, he fashions a water bladder out of his opponent's stomach and is it to...
And
get himself.
It's
just
strong enough to
it.
Float his power armor.
Yeah, and you can dive from platforms into the water. So it basically turns all of the maps on Beta Decima into basically like maps where melee teams always can get cover.
Does it slow you down at all?
It does not slow you down. But like, to be fair, these rules are attached with like a bunch of bonus rules, like whirlpools and currents and hypnotic waters and ocean predators. So like, that's what these rules are made for. But I think just turning the open area into usable terrain, I think actually does a lot to fix some of the boring parts of Beta Decima. Because now you have jumpable areas, swimmable areas, and now you can like swim over two gantries, climb up from underneath them, and then like shank someone, which I think would be cool.
Here's an interaction I didn't think about. Can you climb out of the water onto a platform, or do you have to get on the ground and then climb to a platform?
No, because you can always walk through the floors because they are accessible. You can phase through floors. Gantry floors are accessible.
You know, that would be interesting to see that as a main rule for the kill zone. You bring it up kind of points out that there is a whole narrative part of Kill Team that doesn't really get talked about nearly as much, but it is. It's one of those I don't have the time to run a campaign for it. And if just hopefully someday someone I know does it, because I'd be more than willing to jump into it from a narrative aspect.
Yeah, I think that it feels like, oh, this was like a nice little add-on that increased play space that fixes like the biggest complaint that melee people have with Beta Decima of like, oh, look, these long boards are literally unplayable because I just have two avenues. I run down. I have no cover. I just get shot. Whereas like if you can swim, you can like swim around through the middle, climb up onto the objectives, and like you get shot because people have vantage into the water. But like, that's fine. That's actually like, you know, a trade-off compared to just walking out on dry land and dying. So, yeah, and there's obviously the shot tray is just never going to see competitive play because it's locked away in this narrative box, which is probably going to be sold out instantaneously, and that means that there's only going to be that many copies, and that's all the world will ever see.
Well, you know, people are probably willing to give up that piece of terrain if all they're wanting is the team. So if nothing else, if you want it bad enough, it's probably not that hard to get your hands on it.
Yeah, it is a pretty big piece of chunky plastic. Takes up a ton of the space in the box. And I do think it actually looks pretty fun. Like, it can hold tons of operatives. There's plenty of heavy cover. So there's like a thing where you can like run around on it, which I think is cool. And if you really wanted a unique narrative experience, you could just like get two of them, put them both on the water, and just have people like play in the Matrix and have a shooting hallway. Bring the In the Dark back into the open. Anyways, how are things? Or I guess, you know, is there anything else you want to chat about before we head out? You know, the local scene, the local hangs. I guess Adepticon just came and went, and I'm sure that was really good for your local scene, the Rail Spitter Ruffians, right?
So yeah, I would love to talk about my local scene. So it's been a year since we talked, right after last Adepticon, I'm pretty sure. At the time, I had gone up with a couple guys, and I would say the number of people from my local scene that went to Adepticon basically doubled this time around. To boot, Jason, I think you played some of our guys, Brett and Brayden, who were there. They managed to go undefeated in the team tournament, which I was very happy to see. We are talking about, like, Brett and Brayden are, this is only like their second Adepticon. So to go from like just showing up a year ago to winning like a big event like that is it's really fun to see when your local guys like win their own acclaim like that. Also, here in the Midwest and Central Illinois specifically and Chicago area, Travis, you remember Rob, he was at Adepticon and he is now running events for Kill Team out of the Dice JoJo out of Chicago, which is a very, very popular game store. Their Discord is very, very heavily trafficked. I think they have a 24 person event coming up in 2 months and it like sold out in less than a week. So hopefully in the future we will see maybe something like a GT level event from Rob. Joe Bell, who I'm sure you remember, is still running the Gateway Open out of St. Louis, which is going to be a world of a championship qualifier event, one of the few ones we get here in the Midwest outside of Adepticon. And even in Champaign and Urbana, I'm not sure if you're familiar with that town, but that's it's another one of those 100,000 person, you know, cities, air quotes, that kind of exists out here in Central Illinois area. And they've got a new Kill Team group that literally for their first tournament have already got 16 out of 16 spots filled with over 2 weeks to go before the event even starts. So
nice.
Things are really kind of starting to kick off here in the Midwest. And it's very nice to see.
I love to hear that, man. Especially because, yeah, you came, I think, in June, I think somewhere after, I think you got like another second place Wormblade finish. So not just after Adepticon, but it's good to hear the growth because, you know, we've had Joe on, we've had Rob on, we've had you on twice now. So it's good to hear that things are popping off in the Midwest. Obviously, you know, Jason's out there doing his part also.
Yep, we've got the Icebreaker Renegade event coming up. I think if it didn't just happen, we're going to have the tickets out for that pretty soon.
Jason, is this going to be I might ask you this at Adepticon. Is that going to be a qualifier event or were you guys not able to get permission?
We were not able to get that into a qualifier. Yeah, that would probably help a lot with attendance if we can pull that off for the next one.
Well. All right. Yeah, I mean, that's great to hear all about all of that. Hopefully people in the Midwest can check up the socials. You know, we'll drop your Discord and all the other stuff in there and make sure all of those links are in the show notes. Any other final thoughts about Kill Team Nightmare? Any of the big news basically from this weekend? I think we went over a little bit about our favorite optives, the Skin Thief, the Night Fiend, and all the crazy shenanigans you could do along with the swimming rules. The crazy swimming rules, which JD thought I was just memeing about for the last like 3 days.
I just thought it was like you guys just fucking around. So that's cute. I will say, I guess we've kind of beat Nightmare to death. I really am excited for the future of the game at this point. I could have used that balanced data slate a week prior to when it came out, but it's still all the changes I wanted to see. I'm hard pressed at this point to think of anything that absolutely needs change. I do think Higher Tech are probably going to be the dominant team going forward, but not in the same way that we maybe have seen from things like Chaos Cultists and Felgor. So if anything, the curve is getting flattened. And I think that's what we all kind of want to see. You kind of want to walk up to a table and look at the team across from you and think that your opponent has a chance and just not walk and be like, oh, you brought this team, I roll. Like that's what we want to get away from. And I think we get a bit closer there every time. These two teams, while good, I don't think will break the game's backbone. And I'm really ready for what's the next one? Termination.
Yeah, we're going to get some slightly faster short kings and a whole gaggle of brothers.
Yeah. I want those rules. I want to see them now.
And I guess the final shout out to our newest Patreon supporter, Alvaro. Thanks for joining, man. If you made it all the way to the end of the podcast, thank you for helping to support us and all of our other Patreon supporters.
Yes. And listeners, if you haven't already joined the Discord and or left us a 5-star review on whatever platform you're listening on and or checked out the Discord, we're going to have links for that all in the episode description.